We're doing Parshas Matos. Our Parsha begins with the laws of a vow. We have two types of vows. We have a neder and a shvua. Shvua is when a person takes a vow on a personal level. He says, I will sleep, I won't sleep, I will eat, I won't eat. That's a shvua. We have many types of shvuot. This type of shvua is called the shvuat bitui, levate bisfataim. When a person takes a vow and he expresses, he says, I will or won't do something that is permissible. I'm going to eat chocolate tomorrow. He takes a vow. I swear by God that I will eat chocolate tomorrow. I swear by God that I won't eat chocolate tomorrow. That's a shvua. A neder has a few forms. So a neder in its classical sense is that a person says, this animal is a sacrifice of an ola. Or a person says, I take a vow that I will bring a sacrifice of an ola. Now the Torah teaches us another concept, that we can make a neder where we take the holiness of a sacrifice and we say, this keychain should be forbidden on me the same way that an ola sacrifice is forbidden on me. So I've taken the concept of neder, which is classically revolving around a sacrifice, and I've applied it to my life. So when couples would have a fight, so the wife would sometimes say, deriving any pleasure from you should be prohibited on me all day, as if you were an ola sacrifice, honey. So you've taken the holiness and you've applied it to modern life. Now, Chazal, the Torah, gives us an interesting halacha in this week's parsha, that when it comes to a vow that pertains to the husband, the husband tells the wife, I bought you this new perfume. And the wife says, are you insinuating that my body odor doesn't find favor in your eyes? And the husband says, well, now that you mention it, I didn't want to say it, but she says, you brute, I take a vow. Showers are going to be prohibited on me for the next month, the same way in all the sacrifices prohibited on me. The water of the shower should be prohibited on me like an ola sacrifice. So she takes a neder. The husband says, boy, a wife without a shower, what am I going to do? Comes the Torah and says, the husband has the right to annul that vow. Within the first that day that he hears it, he can annul it. Provided that he doesn't say, great, enjoy, it's all yours. Once he said that, once he upheld the vow, he can no longer annul it. He has to go to a rabbi. Now, when the husband annuls the vow, it's from that moment onward. Meaning, let's say the wife felt bad, and she goes to the bathhouse and takes a shower. And then she comes back home and the husband says, you know what, I felt bad. I'm going to annul your vow right now. It's not nightfall yet. She sinned because she transgressed her vow before he annulled it. If they would go to a rabbi, so then a rabbi has the capacity sometimes to annul a vow retroactively. That's a special concept that we have on tradition from Moshe from Sinai, that a husband, a rabbi can sometimes find a way of annulling a vow retroactively. But if the woman didn't know that the vow was annulled, let's say she took that vow, and the husband chuckles, he goes into his room and says, that vow's annulled. But he doesn't tell her. He figures, let her sweat it out a little bit. Excuse the pun. So she's sweating and she's suffering in the summer, and one day she decides she's going to take a shower. And she comes back home and she says, honey, I did a bad thing. He says, what'd you do? She says, well, I took a shower. I wasn't supposed to. I took a vow. And he says, don't worry, I annulled it. The Torah says she still sinned. Because when a person means to transgress, and then it turns out that they didn't, their intention carries weight. So let's begin with a harsh case, and then we'll walk into modern life. Let's say a guy walks into a McDonald's restaurant, and he wants to have that non-kosher burger. What he doesn't know is that the owner is a tzaddik, and he keeps a stack of kosher burgers on the side, and he waits to see when he has a kosher oven and kosher burgers, and he walks in and says, I'll have a burger, hamburger, literally hamburger. So the owner says, no problem, coming right up. He sees the guy sits, as he sees the guy's pay us. He goes to his side kitchen where he has a kosher oven, he has kosher burgers, throws on the fries, slices the tomatoes with his kosher knife, makes together a burger fully kosher, doesn't say a word, puts it on the same McDonald's tray, comes out and serves it, and the guy sits there and he's slobbering his mouth out and he says, the Jews don't know how to make good meat, and he's eating that hamburger, and finally he comes to pay the bill, and he asks the owner, hey, by the way, what's your name? The guy says, my name is Goldberg. He says, Goldberg? You Jewish by any chance? So the guy says, well, I wouldn't tell if you wouldn't tell.
So, first of all, the store owner is sinning. You're not allowed to serve non-kosher food, even to non-Jews. You're not allowed to have such a business. It's derived from the Torah. You're not allowed to have a business. You're not allowed to own a McDonald's. You're not allowed to sell non-kosher food. But he had this one mishigas. He decided he's going to do a good thing. He didn't know. Yeah, we had students here who used to work in McDonald's and Burger King and stuff. They didn't know. They figured I'm eating kosher food. Okay, so this guy didn't know. Fine. So then the guy tells him, you know, if you're a Jew, so I did a bad thing, didn't I? So the owner says, I got good news for you. I figured you might regret it one day. So I have a special kitchen, I have a special oven, I made you a kosher burger. So the guy starts wiping his brow. He walks out, he goes to the rabbi and says, I know in Judaism we don't have confessions, I don't have to tell you. But you know, look at how God took care of me. I thought one day my Yetzer Hara got the better of me, I thought I'd have a ham burger. And I didn't. So the rabbi tells him, I'm sorry to tell you, Charlie, you still have to do tshuva. But why? I ate kosher meat then. Turns out it was kosher. That's not good enough. That's what the Torah teaches us in our parsha. When a person means to do what's wrong, and he ends up doing what's right, so then he meant to do what's wrong. The fact that later on he discovers that it turned out okay, that doesn't mean anything. So now I'm going to hit home for a second. What would we say? I didn't say that. What would we say if a person drives beyond the speed limit? He drives recklessly. And then when he gets home, he says, nothing happened, I'm okay. I had a friend, we were at a wedding, and he drank. And he drank some more. And then he's getting behind the wheel. And I said, wait a second. Your life, someone else's life. He says, I'm okay, I'm sharp as a fiddle. And anyways, it's nighttime, there aren't that many cars around. I said, you know, you're not allowed to do this. He says, I'll prove it to you, I'll get him okay. I said, no, even if you get home okay, this is still murder what you're doing now. You're playing with your life and someone else's life because your instincts aren't sharp enough. There's a reason why the law says you're not allowed to drive. He says, do you have a license? I don't have a license, but I'll pay for the taxi. Don't drive, you're risking someone else's life. I figured the next day he'd be sober, he'd pay me back. And even if he wouldn't, you know, it's a worthwhile investment. The guy wouldn't listen. And I have a hard time talking to the guy. I have a hard time respecting him anymore. Because the fact that he made it home safe and the fact that the other guy, no one got killed, that doesn't mean anything. If what he did was unsafe, the Torah says a sin is not only gauged by the outcome. A sin is also gauged by my intent. If a person did something that was wrong, he went flying down the highway when it was raining. So he risked his life and someone else's life. The fact that he got home safely doesn't mean that that drive wasn't a sin. But yes?
In the sense that if he was not in the capacity to drive, he was also not in the capacity to make that rational decision. If, I'm saying if he can't drive, he can't. If he says, oh, I'll get home to the venue.
No, he wasn't that. He wasn't drunk.
He fallen down drunk to not be able to drive. I'm
saying he wasn't drunk. But
he was over the limit.
I thought he was over the limit. He thought he was over the limit.
That's the key. He knew that he was.
This is a very harsh.
Presented him with an alternative. See, that really puts the onus on him. You said, "Look, I'll pay for a taxi." Once you say that, he has nothing to stand on. I mean, if he knows himself, would you want your kid driving like that? Your mom driving like that? And I like to have a couple of drinks. So, you know, I'm not saying this from a point of view of somebody who, you know, we have one drink, two drinks early on in the wedding, and then nobody's expecting you not to drive. If you're having a bunch of drinks and you're driving shortly afterwards, it's totally, murder's a tough one, but it's a minimal manslaughter. And then your friend, he says, I'm paying for your taxi. What can you say? What is your defense?
So this is something we have to think about when it comes to a seatbelt, when it comes to driving with a kid, unseatbelt, unbuckled, without a car seat, when it comes to... We do all kinds of stupid things. One of the things I write every year before Purim is, if you're going to drink, then give your keys and your gun to your wife. You know, don't assume. You know, you're asking, where was he? And I say, where were you before you drink? Meaning, I don't buy that excuse. I feel like... If you're going to drink, then you have the responsibility to give your keys and your gun to someone else. Yeah.
What about, actually forcibly stopping the person driving?
That's a good question for a Thursday night. Back to the parsha. So, we have this rule about nidarim. That's mitzvah number one we covered in our parsha. The same is true with the father and his daughter. That deserves a little bit more details to be discussed on a different occasion. We are told, God tells Moshe, go take revenge from the Midianites before you pass away. And here we have an interesting discussion between Moshe and Hashem. God tells Moshe, take the Jews' revenge from the Midianites. Moshe tells the people, take God's revenge from the Midianites. There's a powerful medrash here. Moshe says to God, what do you mean our revenge? The Midianites only hate us because we're your people. If we would eat like them, drink like them, talk like them, be like them, would they hate us? They hate us because we're different people. It's your fight with them. Anti-Semitism stems from the fact that we're your people. Don't tell us to fight our fight. We're fighting your fight against the Midianites. And that's, Chazal say that in the Medrash, that's why God says fight Israel's fight against the Midianites. And Moshe turns to Israel and says, we're going to fight God's fight, God's revenge from the Midianites. And in this war, so we have 1,000 people going to war. Corresponding, we have 1,000 people standing and praying. For each soldier, there was a soldier praying. Now, when the Jews heard that after this war, Moshe's going to die, no one wanted to go to war. And that's why they had to force, the leaders of each tribe had to force the people to go to war. They had to take the volunteers, so to speak, and force them to go out to battle. Now, Pinchas is going to finish the war. Pinchas, who started the job, is the Kohen Mashuach Melchama, and he's going to lead the war, and he's going to ultimately kill Bilam. And when they go to war, Pinchas runs back to that pile of stones that Yaakov and Lavan built, and they made a pact. We will not cross this pile of stones to harm one another. And in that pile of stones, they buried a sword. And they said, whoever crosses this pile of stones will get killed by this sword. So Pinchas uncovers that sword and takes that sword to go. And with that sword, he will ultimately kill Bilam. Because Bilam was a descendant of Lavan. He was Aramean. And he was the one who crossed over that pile of stones. That's where the mule broke his leg against those pile of stones, telling him, what you doing crossing this pile? And he's going to kill him. Where we got 7 minutes left. I'm sorry.
I don't know geographically where was this.
I can't tell you. So they not only destroy the Midianites, they also kill their five kings, Evi, Rekem, Tzur, Hur, and Reva. And they killed Bilam, which is why we have a discussion in last week's parasha, 2 weeks ago, whether Bilam was a prophet or not. How could they kill a prophet? So at the end, he was for sure not a prophet. Meaning, at the end of his life, he was a kosein. He was a sorcerer. Whether he was a prophet initially or not, that's a machlokas. But if he had continued being a prophet, then we wouldn't have been allowed to touch him. So they capture into captivity the women who were never married and their children and their cattle, and they bring them all back. And when they come back, Moshe sees it, and Moshe says, wait a second, how did this whole war start? Because they sent their girls here to cause us to sin. How could you bring them back? So Moshe gets angry at them, and he says, how could you leave all these women around? They're the ones who really brought around the problems. So that's when they Moshe gets upset. And Chazal tell us, whenever a person gets upset, if he's a prophet, he loses his prophecy. If he's a chacham, if he's a rabbi, he loses his knowledge of Torah. If he's a regular person, he loses his intellect. He loses his sanity. A person has to realize that anger brings us down. Whenever a person gets angry, that's it. You're at a loss. Excuse the pun. So Moshe gets angry, and that's why it comes time to teach them the laws of how to purge the vessels, and Moshe isn't the one giving the class. Elazar is. Now, why do we have to purge the vessels? They're bringing home gold, silver, copper, metal vessels, and they want to use them. Now, those vessels were used by the Midianites with non-kosher food. So here we learn that when you use an item with food, that item absorbs from the flavor of the food. And if you want to continue using that item, so then you have to realize that that item has absorbed that flavor of the food. What do you have to do? You wait 24 hours, and then you kosher the item. How do you kosher it? So if it's a pot, so then you used it to boil food in, right? You cooked soup, you cooked something else in it. So then you submerge it in a larger pot of boiling water so that the inside and outside gets boiled. If it's a frying pan, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. It might not be kosherable. Depends on what the frying pan was used with, because frying is not like cooking. Cooking, you use a liquid to cook. Frying, you're really using the heat of the fire, the heat of the pan, the dry heat. There's very little liquid there.
So that's why frying might be like a spoke, just like if you have a grate that you're on your barbecue, on your grill. So there, you're grilling, so it's the flame, the fire, that direct heat that cooks, that bakes, and there the flavor is absorbed through direct heat, and the way to purge it is by putting it directly into a fire. And you have to burn out the flavor. It's not the same as boiling out the flavor. When we boil out the flavor, we say the flavor comes out of the walls of the vessels. When we burn it, we say the flavor gets burnt in the walls of the vessels. It's not that it's coming out. The other halacha that he teaches them is that these vessels came from non-Jewish ownership into Jewish ownership, and they have to immerse them in mikveh water. We have a halacha that when we purchase an item, be it a new vessel or a used vessel, from a non-Jew, so if that vessel was in the non-Jew's ownership, and now it's going to a Jew's ownership, so then that vessel has to be immersed in a mikveh. Now, let's say you're a store owner. So you buy a bunch of cups from China. You want to sell them. Glass also has to be immersed in a mikveh. Do you have to toivel all your cups, all your dishes? The answer is no, because you didn't purchase it for use. You purchased it for resale. Any vessel that comes in direct contact with the final preparation of food, a vessel that comes in direct contact with the final preparation of food has to be submerged in a mikveh before we use it, provided that vessel is made out of one of the metals or glass, right? We don't hold that you have to toivel plastic, but you do have to toivel anything made of metal or glass. If it's a wood vessel, it does not have to be toiveled. If it's earthenware, so being that earthenware is glazed with glass, so here in Israel, the custom is to toivel it. In America, not. In Israel, yes. Porcelain, we toivel. China, we toivel. Just be careful it shouldn't drop and fall. When you go to a mikveh to toivel your vessels, try to go to one of the mikvehs which have a reachable bottom, meaning there are two types of kelim mikvehs. Some are very deep. You drop your fork, you lost it. That's it. You can sit there for 10 hours trying to get it out, but chances are you lost it. And don't try diving in. That's how people die, because it's not wide enough for you to turn around. Don't try diving in. They have baskets. I spent a lot of time trying to get that. Go to our kelim mikvos where the bottom is very high, where it's reachable. You could reach the bottom. Go to one of those. Save yourself the headache. Now, there's much more to be discussed. If you want, tomorrow night we'll continue.